Beware, spoiler phobes. You've stumbled upon a storm of spoilers. Have you felt the weather outside? Have you sent your children back to school? Are you back in school yourself? You must know that fall is here. This week on A Storm of Spoilers, each host will mention some films, television, books, and comics that they think you should keep a lookout for. Because you know we will. Let's bring in the horns. To a storm of spoilers. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I can see into the future, and fall is coming.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I have locked Game of Thrones producer Brian Cogman in my basement in order to extract spoilers from him. So if you hear the occasional thumping throughout this episode, that's what it is.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I have not kidnapped anyone this week. Which is good, I think. I feel like it's pretty, is on the whole, this is a pretty good development.
As opposed to last week when you had to go to another state to kidnap somebody. Or I guess last week. In case you guys didn't catch our last episode last week, it was a crossover episode with the Thought Bubble. I'm not sure what to call it. It was a magical time, though. We covered some comic book goodness, but usually this podcast is about Game of Thrones, and then we decide to spin off into our various pop culture proclivities. This week, we will be giving you a fall preview of what some of those proclivities, recommendations, interests are. But and before we do all that, let's see how we've been doing thus far. Joanna, are there any non-Brian Cogman Morse code reviews for us today?
He's pretty persistent. All right, this non-Cogman review comes from Alex Wilch 71. Keep on spoiling, 5 stars. This is the only Game of Thrones podcast I can bear listening to because others I've heard dance around anything that could possibly be labeled a spoiler at the cost of having a nuanced discussion about the series. Even when it's production stuff I haven't heard before, the spoilers deepen my understanding of the episode and the series as a whole. All the hosts are so intelligent, knowledgeable in the subject matter, and fun to listen to. And I love the social justice warrior perspective. The world needs more of it. So that's a... Brian, stop. That's
three
a glowing recommendation.
Yes.
That's a glowing recommendation from Alex. I'm gonna read one part of one more because it starts with stuff that's too nice and embarrassing, so I'm not gonna read that. But this is by Villette 3606. May the off-season tour never end. 5 stars. And eventually, Villette says, the off-season tour episodes have been equally wonderful. Long may they continue. They have consistently picked interesting, varied pop culture texts to do deep dives into. And when I've known exactly zero about the text in question, I've still been consistently entertained and enlightened by their explorations and reflections on it. As a historian, their Hamilton episode especially has a place in my heart. Even though 2/3 of the podcasters claim to not be into history, they did a darn good job of charmingly nerding out about it for an hour and change. If you're interested in sharp, funny pop culture discussions by very well-informed and thoughtful commentators, which always have a feminist social justice warrior core to them, which is so rare and so welcome and wonderful, this is one of the very best places in the podcasting world to go. Thanks for all the not spoiling but enriching, y'all. So that was the like less effusive part of the review, which Jeez. Is why I didn't read the first part. Anyway, you guys are so nice. Again, please don't leave us negative reviews or 0 stars or anything like that. But if you have any construction criticism, like to make this not be a love fest every week, please feel free to leave a review for us.
Yeah, and don't set the bar so high next time, guys. It's a lot to live up to.
I imagine the first overly effusive part of that review was talking about we used to be exclusively Game of Thrones, textual based, talking about books, talking about spoilers. And we still like to keep our finger on the pulse of Game of Thrones with our weekly ravens from Maester Neil. Neil, any Game of Thrones news for us this week?
Well, we got a bunch of Game of Thrones news. Although I would like to correct something that I said last week. We do not have a release date for The Winds of Winter. There was leaks or rumors that I think it was Amazon France said had a March 9th, 2017 date up, and that has since been debunked.
Yeah.
Ugh, the French.
Yeah, the French.
Mon Dieu.
So that is not a thing, but there is Game of Thrones news. The Creative Arts Emmys were held this week, and Game of Thrones won 9, including Outstanding Special Effects for the Battle of the Bastards, and Outstanding Stunt Coordination, which is very cool, and a bunch of makeup, prosthetic makeup, costumes, pretty much everything except for cinematography, and unfortunately, guest star, which Max von Sydow lost to Hank Azaria in Ray Donovan. Wow, I'm amazed that I remembered that. Anyway, so Game of Thrones won a bunch of the cool, nerdy, artsy Emmys, which is great. And then the big Emmy Awards are, what, this coming weekend after
yes.
the show posts? So we'll talk about if they win any big awards next week.
And aren't they running to be like the most awarded something, Joanna?
Yes, as I talked about on Fighting in the War Room, over the weekend they broke the record for most awarded drama. So with their 9 technical Emmys, they are now the most awarded drama, beating West Wing and one other show that I can't remember. If they win 2 Emmys on Sunday, which they likely will, they will beat Frasier to become the most awarded scripted show on television. They still have yet to beat Saturday Night Live, which is in a third category, but they just keep breaking records is the point. And I want to say my favorite creative / technical Emmy that went out is the fact that Michelle Clapton, who's the costume designer, won an Emmy despite the fact that she only designed costumes for 1 episode, which was the finale. Like basically she just did Cersei's costume in the finale, or that's the one she's talked about most, but they had a different costume designer for like the rest of the season. And I commented that I didn't really like those costumes. So it's almost like she won the Emmy for like, oh, thank God you're back. Thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Cool. So beyond winning awards for season 6, there are some season 7 details. One is one true and one false casting thing. The false one was the rumor that Angela Lansbury would be joining the cast. That was debunked by Entertainment Weekly, among others. And the one that's true is Jim Broadbent, who you'll know from films such as Moulin Rouge or
Harry Potter,
Hot Fuzz, or oh yes, Harry Potter. Who did he play in Harry Potter? What was that?
Professor Slughorn.
Slughorn.
All right, so he's going to finally be. You know, it's basically
or his Academy Award winning turn in Iris. Duh, guys.
Yeah, that too. So it's at this point, Game of Thrones, I feel, has a pretty good pick of the litter of British actors. Like whoever they want, they can probably get. So the question is, who is Jim Broadbent going to play? And we had this discussion on Twitter, but my thought is he feels very Archmaester of the Citadel type of guy to me, especially since they went kind of goofy with Frank Vaughn playing one of the maester that Sam meets. Last year, like they went kind of light, and I feel like Jim Broadbent could play that light, but also play someone you believe is deeply versed in history and things like that.
Yeah, here's why I definitely think he's playing the Maester of the Citadel is that like a couple weeks or a week or so before the Broadbent news went out, Watchers on the Wall had a listing of a bunch of casting calls like they do every year. Which are vague casting calls without a name attached to them. And the one, you know, and this is how we all figured out who Ian McShane was playing last year. So the one that matches Jim Broadbent best is definitely the Archmaester of the Citadel. Like, that's definitely who it is. The reason why I think that's valid is Entertainment Weekly, which we know likes to sort of sometimes speak for the network, I would say, made a point of saying, hey, there are some casting descriptions out there, but just so you know, they're probably not true, maybe, so you should just don't look at them. Don't look at them. It's fine. Just don't look at them. It's fine. So, which made me...
It's like the Wizard of Oz. Yeah. Like, don't look at these things over here.
They were like, the network sent out false casting calls to various... whatever. But I talked to Sue from Watching the Wall. Those casting calls are for real, so I think we can all look forward to seeing him delightfully interact with Sam next season, which is
right.
Great.
And it does feel like the kind of role that, you know, you may end up being in only like one or two episodes, maybe three tops. So yeah, think that somebody with as busy, I guess, as Jim Broadbent, that works well, kind of like Ian McShane last year.
I think it'll be less McShane and more actually like
Max von Sydow.
No, Jonathan
Pryce?
Yeah, thank you. Jonathan Pryce. Thank you. Only because the one word that Entertainment Weekly used, which came officially from Game of Thrones, is significant. Like, Max von Sydow and Ian McShane, from the start, we were told their appearances would be small or brief. But the word for Broadbent was significant, and the description... is priest in his 60s. He's a venerable priest with a moral authority and gravitas. The show is seeking a white actor using an RP, which is received pronunciation accent, with characterful face for this part. He's scheduled to shoot 1 week. So yeah, actually 1 week's not that much. You might be right, Neil. Mm-hmm. If all those stars line up. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even if they double Sam's on-screen time next year, it's still not that much.
That's true. But, you know, the maester... in the books, could go off and interact with Daenerys. Like, there are some options for this maester to not just be at the Citadel. So
we know that they're shooting stuff on beaches. We just don't know where those beaches are in Westeros.
Right.
So, and then the last piece of Game of Thrones news, which is, we're starting to get there. We're starting to get a little heavier. We're going to have more and more of this in the coming weeks because all of the actors are arriving in Ireland and Spain. And one of the, I believe this also came from Watchers on the Wall, who have a very solid track record, especially when they, you know, sort of put their name on a rumor. And this is that there will be some sort of clash between the Greyjoys, potentially at sea. So we're talking Theon and Yara and old Uncle Euron.
Good old Uncle Euron.
So, and I guess the main theories that are out there right now is that Euron will ultimately team up with Cersei in some way, or he just comes after them. But there's a lot of questions around this. Joanna, have you had a chance? I was on vacation, so this is about the knowledge that I have, but have you had a chance to really dig into this one yet?
I've not dug into it, no. But I think it's a little early on this rumor. But yeah, I have nothing much to add.
Wasn't one of my gasping hopes that he has the dragon horn and like just sails out to the middle of the fleet and just is the only thing that could stop it? Because I would still like that to happen.
I still love that. Although I think it's funny, I didn't really get a chance to listen to it, but the one of the other fine Game of Thrones podcasts out there, Game of Owns, which is, again, Watchers on the Wall, their episode title this week was Burn the Horns. And I was like, interesting. So it seems as if some people might be willing to give up on the idea that there will be horns involved in destroying either the wall or stealing dragons. But I don't think we should give up hope just yet because those horns are easy to explain away. It's like a 30-second thing. Like a maester, Sam finds a book and it's like, oh, they have these horns. And then you just see someone blow one and shit happens. So...
The one other piece of information that Watchers on the Wall had is that Euron catches up to Yara and Theon and captures one of them.
Oh, poor Theon.
Probably Theon. So
he's had a rough life. It's weird that we feel bad for him now, but kind of do.
Yeah. So, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, that's it for now for Game of Thrones land.
The one thing I will say is that if you are listening to this on Wednesday, September 14th, you should go over to VanityFair.com because there will be an interview with Anne Grohl, who is George R. Martin's publisher, longtime publisher. and 10 exclusive images from the new illustrated edition of Game of Thrones up on VanityFair.com. So,
would you like to spoil your own interview and tell us when the damn book's coming out?
You're so cute that you think I got her to tell me that. I mean, click over to find out. Because it's definitely in there if you click. And tell all your friends to click on it.
Get those clicks.
No, but there's some fun, some really fun stuff in there. And awesome. The images are pretty cool. So
we'll make sure we tweet that from the @StormOfSpoilers account, which everyone listening to this should be following anyway.
Excellent.
Lots of cool things.
Yeah.
Including, I imagine, a lot of our things that we're going to preview on this episode. So I think we went sort of loosey-goosey with what we were doing until the last
wait.
Moment. Oh, yeah.
I forgot the best part about the Greyjoy story. I'm sorry. I feel like I let you all down.
All right.
Because I was just skimming
you
it.
You have dug into this.
Well, not too deep, but... He and Cersei are supposedly teaming up, Euron Greyjoy, and Watch of the Wall has a line that says, "We've also heard that Euron will take out at least one of the Sand Snakes." Yay! Okay, I'm so sorry, Dave.
Wait, please okay, so if we had to start a betting pool on which Sand Snake goes, I'm thinking the oldest one, Obara.
You think because she had to go film Roadies?
Maybe.
I'm thinking it's, I'm going to put my money on Star Wars Sand Snake.
And what's her name?
Jessica, Sellers. Yeah.
No, just no.
Leave me with
sorry.
Boobs? Boobs
yeah.
Sand
yeah,
Snake?
Yeah.
All right.
You can have bad pussy.
It leaves you with the bad pussy.
I'll take it. It'll really piss Bronn off.
All right. So we placed our bets. Obara, Jessica Henwick, bad pussy is their official names. And yeah, we'll see.
All right.
On to my horrible transition that I was making about how this episode is about fall previews. We've just like loosely defined the fall to be meaning now when you've heard this podcast on Wednesday to November. And we're going to talk about picks that we have that are interesting to us, either as recommendations or as things that we're definitely checking out. We're probably checking all these things out. We're going to go movies, and then we're going to spend some time talking about TV. Then we're going to do books and or comic books, and we each have some picks. It's loose structure. It's how we're going to go. If you've ever heard like a Fighting in the War Room top 10 episode, I imagine we're going to have a little crossover with that in the sense that I'm going to randomly call on people like, Neil, what's a movie you're looking forward to this fall?
So one of them is, and I feel like I'm going hardcore populist here, guys. But obviously, I think number one is Doctor Strange. Although we're talking about it off air, it doesn't necessarily sound like that's true across the board. But I think that, you know, it's funny. The other day, my roommates sat down. My Captain America Civil War DVD or Blu-ray showed up, and they were watching it. And I watched the first hour or so with them. And at one point, I just kind of turned and said, "Man, it feels like this came out a year ago." At this point,
yes,
like it feels so long since Civil War because it was the absolute first movie of the summer, the technical summer in May. And it feels like it's been a long time, and we've talked a lot about DC and all the DC problems, and it's been a long time since we've had a Marvel movie to pick apart. And Doctor Strange presents us with some interesting things. One, it presents this new element to the DC universe, the mysticism of Doctor Strange. Two, it's potentially Marvel's most problematic movie with all of its weird race bending. And so it could, this is, I think, for the first time in a while, the first Marvel movie that I am excited about, but also kind of nervous about a little bit because it's just such a weird turn compared to all the somewhat safe stuff they've been doing. And so I think, and I also, I find Scott Derrickson as a filmmaker to be equal parts interesting and frustrating because some of his horror stuff is amazing and some of his, like, Day of the Earth Stood Still remake is just terrible. So it's interesting. And yeah. I think that Doctor Strange, just from a curiosity standpoint, is very, very high on my list.
Well, it's also one of the few Marvel movies that is really leading on the casting of its main actor. like, at least for me, in terms of being on the inside of, like, picks that immediately line up with, you know, somebody you could see playing it, like, Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark is probably the last one that I, like, thought was, like, this perfect, is to bring Benedict Cumberbatch in as Doctor Strange here. Mostly because I think that what he's portrayed on other shows and not so much his film work, but definitely his television work on Sherlock makes me think that he's going to be able to find the Doctor Strange that's in between, like, the crazy batshit original Silver Age Doctor Strange and what I think Marvel needs this piece of the Infinity War puzzle to be. So I'm hoping he rolls not Snake Eyes, sixes. That's what we want. Sevens?
Sevens.
Isn't sixes sevens. Snake Eyes? I don't know. Hopefully he does well.
Snake Eyes is one.
Oh, yeah, okay. Do you feel that we're going to get emails about that, I'm sure?
Oh, yeah. We got to do our crafts episode next
enthusiasts.
Year.
Yeah. Guys and dolls enthusiasts, please send us an email.
It also, from a Marvel standpoint, feels like the first time that fan casting has come true.
Yeah.
Because everything else, like even the Robert Downey Jr. thing, was very Marvel-driven, and they've, to a great extent with a lot of their major characters, found people who were either had been around a little bit and were, you know, I would call them B-tier stars, and or they found people who have come out of nowhere, like Tom Holland. So it is interesting that this is their first real shot. Like, even Downey Jr., when they cast him as Iron Man, wasn't at the height of his power. You know, he was still right on the comeback from...
Would you call Paul Rudd a B-tier? He might be. I'm just curious.
Well, but, like, that movie wasn't on him, and it had Michael Douglas coming in. Yeah. And be like, also, I was Ant-Man.
Well, so. I mean, Doctor Strange has Tilda Swinton and Chiwetel Ejiofor, like... It's got some right, other sort of shoulders to hang on.
They're like of quality of Benedict Cumberbatch, not like above. I would like argue that Michael Douglas is a bigger get than Paul Rudd.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, and I think this is, yeah, this feels like the first time where it's massively single star driven and it's the one that everybody wanted.
You know, when you asked me off air about sort of Doctor Strange or why it wasn't on my list or whatever, I think what I've done, and I don't know when I did it, it might have been around the whitewashing controversy. It actually was probably when I heard Benedict Cumberbatch's American accent that I shut down my expectations. I just shut them down. I'm still going to see it. And if it's great, I'm going to be so excited. I don't anticipate it's going to be bad. I don't anticipate it's going to be Suicide Squad. I'm just ratcheting the expectations all the way down so that whatever happens, I will be, I will enjoy it. And, yeah, that's kind of what I did with Ant-Man. They weren't like super down for Ant-Man, but I was just pretty like, Ant-Man can be fine and I'll be happy. And I thought Ant-Man was really good. And so I was really happy, you know? So that's how I feel going into Doctor Strange, where I'm just like, I'm not sure. I don't know.
It's interesting that both of those movies were the second Marvel movie of their respective year.
Yeah. The fall movies are always the weird ones, which is what we were hoping for when they plopped Guardians of the Galaxy in. And it was like, hey, if this one works, then maybe we'll have a pocket for a weird Marvel movie every once in a while. And they keep doing it. I mean, I don't think next year is going to be different because you got Spider-Man throwing off the rhythm. But, you know, three weird Marvel movie things. I still, like, continually impressed. I did a ranking on Geek.com of all the Marvel Cinematic Universe battles. And, like, rewatching them, I'm still impressed that they took, like, Iron Man, who was, like, caricature for famous for one story where he was an alcoholic, and managed to make him super famous and popular and not at all centered around anything that story represents. So, like, the power that Marvel Cinematic Universe has to sort of warp its own characters into blockbusters, like, I'm still in awe of it. And I'm getting to the point where the schadenfreude when one of these actually falls on its face is going to be equally as entertaining as if it succeeds.
You mean like Ultron?
I think
Zynga.
Like, Ultron was boring, but it managed to be profitable enough. I'm just waiting for one to be like just bad.
A flop.
Yeah. Just like Suicide Squad. I'm waiting for Marvel's Suicide Squad.
I feel like at this point, Disney is just not going to let it happen, like no matter what.
I do want to talk about the Benedict Wong thing. This, you know, this is a second cycle in this whitewashing drama, this time from director Scott Derrickson, who was talking about addressing, you know, why he was excited about casting Tilda Swinton. Basically, he like took a shot at Black Widow, which was weird, but he was like, well, we thought it'd be really cool to have a woman in the Marvel Cinematic Universe who wasn't in leather pants. And I was like, fuck you, buddy. I like Black Widow. But anyway, yeah, yay Tilda Swinton. We all agree, yay Tilda Swinton. We love her. Older women in films and blockbusters, all good. Then he's like, but when we decided to cast her, then we had cut the, you know, Is the character's name Wong? Because the actor's Benedict Wong. What's the character's name?
Wong. Yeah, it is Wong.
Okay. So Wong, played by Benedict Wong, that character was cut from the script and they decided to bring it back because they had, you know, whitewashed, you know, Tilda Swinton's character. And I will say that sitting at Comic-Con watching the Doctor Strange presentation, I was watching it thinking, before I knew this, thinking they're leaning so hard on Benedict Wong. It's sort of like what we talked about with Kubo when they're like, George Takei is in this. They're like, Benedict Wong is in this movie. He's fourth billed in the movie. I'm pretty sure, maybe fifth, maybe after Rachel McAdams. But like, I'm pretty sure he's above Mads Mikkelsen. Like, he's got such high billing. And if his part does not bolster that, I call bullshit. So we'll see. We shall see. But
I don't think that Scott Derrickson's comment about the leather pants thing is that bad, though. Like, I think that's a sort of okay thing to aspire to. Is like, oh, we're going to have like a powerful female character who we're not sexualizing in any way, because so far that's kind of where they've gone with a lot of these characters.
I think he could have said, I mean, it's mean to pick apart someone's words, but like, I do agree that that was his larger intent. I think he could have said it in a way where he didn't throw Natasha under the bus, because other than Iron Man 2, I quite like the Natasha character. So,
and she wears jeans in Civil War, so,
so
and
there
a very
you go.
Stylish jacket. So,
there's that. There you go.
All right, so Doctor Strange definitely on the list.
Sweet. Let's pivot over to something maybe less controversial with Joanna.
What's that?
Oh well, let's pick a movie from the fall.
Okay. Well, I feel like this is a safe space after we did our Hamilton episode and everyone responded so positively to it, for me to talk about La La Land, which is the new Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone joint, that has gotten rave reviews at Venice, at, Telluride. I think it was at Telluride, and now at Toronto. Everyone who's seen it pretty much loves it, which I didn't expect because I loved the trailer, but I was bracing myself for the movie to not be very good. But by all accounts, it's very, very, very good. Emma Stone, I have to do this because I work for Vanity Fair. Emma Stone's name is like at the front runner for the best actress Oscar race now. Like, this is a thing. This is a thing that's coming. So the lover of old school Hollywood musicals and me, the lover of that part of Crazy Stupid Love where Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling just flirt with each other, is all in for this. I'm really excited. So
also, did you guys see Whiplash?
I did see Whiplash. Yes.
Same director, Damien Chazelle, who's really, really talented.
Yeah, the Whiplash is, I was just thinking about Whiplash today because I hate Miles Teller so much and I resent Whiplash because it's like the one exception in my long streak of hating Miles Teller because I love that movie and he's so good in it. So I have to grudgingly admit that he has talent, even though I just vehemently dislike him. Do you ever do that? Resent someone for being okay sometimes? No, just me? Okay.
I feel like I probably did that with Miles Teller at some point.
Did I find a way to bring controversy even to my own pick? Sorry. Dave, is La La Land on your radar?
I mean, I definitely want to see it. It's not something that I am going to go too far out of my way to see, but it sounds like I'm not going to have to. So, hey, date movie is what it sounds like to me.
Nice.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and I feel like this, there's no such thing as a non-safe space to talk about Ryan Gosling movies.
Ryan Gosling dancing in good clothing. Oh no, you guys, it's going to be so good. But Emma Stone, I'm equally have a crush on Emma Stone, so.
Yeah, you don't got to sell me on Emma Stone.
And I'm curious, you know, John Legend has like an acting role in this. This is his first like significant acting role. I'm not saying his part is, you know, huge, but he talked about trying to break into acting with this project. So I'll be curious to see if he's actually any good, or if he's just a beautiful set of golden pipes. We'll find out.
I always support my fellow Ohioan, John Legend.
My pick is going to be a Japanese movie that will only be available for you all to see briefly in October, thanks to Funimation, who's going to put it out for, I think, 4 days. But it is Shin Godzilla, which was previously Godzilla Resurgence, but they've decided to keep its Japanese title, which means New Godzilla, because it is ridiculously successful. I'm told it's made 3 billion yen at the Japanese box office. I don't know what that means, but it's successful enough that it has outgrossed the 2014's Godzilla's release in Japan, which basically means that Godzilla is back. Toho, the company that made him originally, is making this one. This one in particular, from what I could tell, might not translate as well to American audiences, because instead of being about World War II nuclear power tests, it is more about how the Japanese government reacted to the 2011 earthquake tsunami and the Fukushima nuclear reactor meltdown. So Godzilla is a more... This is going to get kind of spoilery, but I'm assuming people don't care, because I can't like actually show you pictures of it. I could just describe it. But Godzilla is more a different organism now. He starts absorbing masses of stuff in the sea and like gains sentience. And he actually grows into 3 different forms once he hits land and just starts destroying Tokyo. Meanwhile, the government and businesses and Americans are all coming together, and basically the bureaucracy that the Japanese government has in place isn't fast enough to react to large-scale disasters, drawing our, you know, parallel for a giant monster movie. Yeah, crazy stuff goes down. It's from the director of Neon Genesis Evangelion. So apparently not only is there some Evangelion tracks that show up, but a lot of crazy anime shit that goes down, like he's gonna shoot his fire things out of his back spikes, and has like a little skull thing on his tail, and his tail's really long. Anyway, looks really weird. I'm always up for another Godzilla. I've been into Godzilla since I could remember watching movies. I bought my tickets. You guys can too at the Funimation site, but you are looking in the window of October 11th through the 18th, somewhere in your state.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. What a day recommendation.
I'm super excited about this for several reasons. One, Godzilla's the king, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny we talk about adaptations and appropriation and how many movies have been brought from countries like Japan and readapted for American audiences. And this is a chance for you to go to a theater and see a Japanese made Godzilla movie, which is kind of a rare deal. And I also think it's a good excuse to get into Godzilla and then see the 2014 version, which I liked a lot and is also directed by Gareth Edwards, who I believe has another movie coming out later this year.
What? Yes. Could it
be? It falls outside of the fall preview, though, so right. I can't imagine we'll ever talk about it.
Gareth Edwards.
At some point, we'll go rogue and talk about that one.
Yeah. I think, to answer Neil's question that he sort of posed, the last movie, Japanese Godzilla movie you could have seen in theaters was Godzilla 2000, in the year 2000. And it was not good.
Right.
I mean, at some point, Godzilla gets, like, swallowed by another monster. But, like, the point of the movie ended up being, like, there's part of Godzilla in all of us and we should protect it. It was just not good. I'm so into a Godzilla movie that is about Japanese politics, as people who've long listened to Game of Thrones. Like, if you combine polygons and foreign politics, you're basically making a movie for me.
Oh, polygons and politics. The Dave Gonzalez story.
Call them politigons.
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 Neil, you have another movie for us?
I do. And it's sort of a monster-ish movie.
I guess we'll all find out together.
Another sci-fi thriller. This one, another festival movie, which it comes from director Denis Villeneuve, who did Sicario and another movie that Prisoners, an Enemy. So a bunch of really good, sort of gritty, realistic movies. And then this one is about humanity meeting aliens. And it stars Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner and Forest Whitaker. It's called Arrival. It has been getting some very good reviews out of the same festivals that La La Land is playing. So Telluride in Toronto. And I am seeing it at Fantastic Fest at the end of this month, which I'm very excited about. And eventually it's going to come out in November, November 11th. And the trailer, if you haven't seen it, we'll shoot a link out to it. But very interesting, and from what I hear, and hopefully this isn't too spoilery, but from what I hear, it's less about, like, it's not the Independence Day-style alien movie that we've seen so many times where it's all about being attacked. It's more on the contact side of the spectrum, where it's aliens come to communicate and tell us something. Mm. So someone actually did describe it as like the younger, shinier, potentially better, bigger, faster, better version of Contact, which I love Contact, so I'm game.
Yeah, Contact's the I have a difficult relationship with Contact in disliking it, then liking it, then disliking it, and now I'm coming back up to liking it. Sign curve.
Did you read the book?
I did not read the book.
I have the coolest book reading experience with that one, because I read it for physics class in high school. I was in a physics class and we basically got to do English class, which I hated physics and I love English class anyway. So yeah, we read That's Contact. Awesome. And then I think the movie came out like a couple years after that, like when I was in college, I think is when it came out. Mm-hmm. And so I with the trepidation of a book reader went to that movie and was like, this isn't good. And then I watched it and I was like, it's pretty good in places. And it's definitely grown on me over the years.
I mean, McConaughey. It's proof that it's proof that adapting Carl Sagan is hard.
Yeah, sure is.
It's like Stephen King. It's like it's just hard. But the other reason why you should see Arrival, the director of Arrival is also directing the Blade Runner sequel, sequel.
I was about to say
2017.
Villeneuve has been like on all these websites talking about not just the Blade Runner sequel that he's making, but also how he wants to do Dune. Like, basically, he wants to be our new sci-fi king. And
I'm totally good with it.
He can have it.
He's a really good director.
He is.
Yeah, I don't know. We could talk about Prisoners later.
Well, we can talk after we all have seen Arrival. How about that?
Yeah,
fair enough.
That sounds fun.
Okay.
Joanna, this one I'm looking forward to, because it looks like a lot of fun. What's your next fall movie?
All right, I decided to join the populist train after my arty musical input and say Magnificent Seven, which is the social justice warrior of blockbusters. My dad's really against it because of that they have like put some more non-white people in the cast. He's like anti-Denzel, which is hilarious. But yeah, so the Magnificent Seven, which is a remake of the Magnificent Seven, which is a remake of the Seven Samurai. And as Neil pointed out off air, also throw A Bug's Life in there, is a story we just keep telling over and over again about some ragtag heroes, reluctant heroes, to a certain degree, protecting a town from some bad guys. So the Three Amigos maybe should be in there too. I don't know.
Yeah, these are all Seven Samurai related.
and so it's got Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, Peter Sarsgaard, who was my one and only for a while, is doing a great villainous turn, and it just looks really fun. And I was worried. This is a theme. Like, when I enjoy a preview, I always get worried. I was worried, but it premiered quite well at Toronto. People liked it. And so that comes out the 23rd. I think my sister and I are going to take my dad kicking and screaming to go see it, because it just seems like a dad movie. So we're taking him, and he's going to like it against as well, even though he's mad that the girl gets to fire a gun or whatever. What do you guys think about it?
I mean, it looks like I didn't like it based on its name, and then I saw the trailer, and I'm like, okay, maybe there is a reason to do this, because maybe I do want to have fun with this specific group of people that you've assembled. Because otherwise, I'm like, remaking The Magnificent Seven sounds like something that you absolutely don't have to do. But yeah, the closer I get to it, the more I'm given in to the blockbustery nature of having those particular actors sort of just mugging around. It's the Ocean's 11 of this year.
Oh yeah, okay. Two things. Number one, well, three things. Now, number one, if they make Magnificent Eight, I will kill myself. That's my promise to you on air. Number two, I forgot to mention, of course, that this is Antoine Fuqua, who directed Training Day, which is where we last saw Denzel and Ethan Hawke sort of doing stuff together. So that's a fun reunion. And then the third thing is, and this is a black mark against The Magnificent Seven, is that Nick Pizzolatto, True Detective fame, who I have very little respect for, even though that first season was really good, wrote screenplay.
Yeah, so, even though, you know, he went from novel to writing a whole season of a great... No respect. That's cool.
he plagiarized a bunch of the first season. He worked on it for, like, I don't know, a decade, and it was really good. And then he tried to do something again, and it was bad. And also, there was another movie that was bad.
It didn't live up to hype. It wasn't.
No, we've had this discussion before. I know we've had this discussion before. It was bad.
It was also co-written by John Lee Hancock, who wrote the adaptation of The Blind Side. So not the worst.
Magnificent Seven.
Yeah. So, like, I think there's an interesting eclectic gathering of talent for this movie. I've also heard from various staff members of the website that I run who have seen it that the last, like, 30 minutes is just bonkers. Just, like, bonkers make action balls. And so I'm like, okay, maybe I will see it then. Because I was out on Magnificent Seven for sure. Because, you know, I'm a Seven Samurai homer. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, all right, cool. Maybe I will see it then.
Guys, I'm ready for bonkers action balls. I think we're going to try to see it at our Alamo Drafthouse, provided that it's going to play it. And
it does feel like the kind of movie you need, like, a basket of chicken wings.
Yes.
And a beer.
A frosty beer. I won't be drinking a beer because it's Sober September. But in my soul will be full of beer. So that's my second movie choice. Dave, what's yours?
Mine is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, mostly because I hope it's good, but it's at least going to kick off more interest in the Wizarding World, which I've discovered in the past couple months I'm still super invested in. So more information is always good information, even if they lead to arguments with my girlfriend about J.K. Rowling's intentions. That's fine. I was in the pocket for Harry Potter, and I think if you were too, then you're with me on this train. So in the hopes that it's good and we don't get, you know, a trilogy forced down our throats for no reason, it kicks off a new time period for a trilogy of films in a fictional universe established by a book series. So once again, kind of my alley.
And hey, listen, I mean, if it encourages communication, that's all any relationship needs is solid communication.
That's right.
So there you go.
Davey's your go-to expert on all these beasts and possibly where to find them. Yeah.
Well, because they didn't release a digital version of that short, so you still have to go and buy the paperback, and it was originally released for a Comedy Relief charity. But I'm convinced they didn't release it because they knew the movie was coming and they didn't want it to, like, clash or give anything away, because some of those things in the trailer are visually identifiable and have not been announced officially by, like, Warner Brothers yet.
Here is, like, Dave with your beastie spoilers, bro.
It's fun. But I don't know, like, I don't know necessarily what that means, because I don't know the overarching plot outside of there's that one beast that we talked about that has that special power that we forgot the name of, where they expand until they fill the space. And if one of them gets out of, like, an entanglement cage, then maybe you need Colin Farrell to track it down.
So Colin Farrell's an auror, and then I was reading some spoilers, Fantastic Beasts spoilers to follow, that Samantha Morton is like head of a, what, puritanical society almost, that's, you know, that invokes the word Salem to try to get rid of wizards and witches in the New World. And that Ezra Miller plays her, what, resentful adopted son?
Who, yeah, I think they'll
is
be
probably actually a wizard. Like, she hates magic, but he's secretly magical and then will be evil and Voldemort-y is the theory, right?
Yeah, well, you could sort of see the outline of where she's going by what they've released thus far about a magical history of North America. You know, problematic though some of it may be, she plugged the actual plot point she wanted to convey into it somewhere. So I think that he's probably, you know, of a scourer family, just been around since the Puritan times, and that their interaction with the magical community in America is actually what keeps the two segregated still. So, you know, a whole bunch of fun problematic things to talk about when that comes out, or we could just figure
watch
out what
it.
The magical beasts are.
I didn't mean to bring up problematic stuff. I just like the idea
that's what people love about you. That's why you're here.
I just meant to bring up the fact that Ezra Miller is, in theory, like the big bad of this franchise, which I, you know, like we need to talk about magical Kevin or whatever. And like,
I like we need to talk about magical Kevin.
And I also like a part of that story that I read about it talked about how he pitched Warner Brothers to get the part as both the Flash and like the big bad maybe of the new Harry Potter franchise, basically like invoking Humphrey Bogart and saying the studio system used to back stars. I want to be that for you, Warner Brothers. Put me in your big tentpole movies. And I mean, and then Ezra Miller shows up to Comic-Con dressed as Gandalf. Like, I don't, like, he's just like, I'm here for it, whatever it is.
He's living his best life.
Yeah, he
really is.
I'm your Daniel Radcliffe now.
Needless to say, we're probably going to end up needing an entire episode to unpack Fantastic Beasts, but gladly we'll go down that hole again, I'm sure.
It'll be super fun, but we're going to have a lot of stuff to do this fall because, of course, television is back and is our next category. Neil, what's going to be some of the TV that's going to be picking your brain this fall?
My first one's an easy one, especially for folks who enjoyed last week's episode when we crossed over to the Thought Bubble. It is Luke Cage, which is incoming on Netflix. It's what, a couple weeks away? Right? The 30th? Yeah. Anyway, Luke Cage, very excited to see this for a number of reasons. One, Luke Cage is a very cool character, and Mike Coulter really sold it in Jessica Jones. And two, it, you know, not to get too into the social justice warrior corner, but it really is the Marvel show that the world could kind of need right now. You know, it's about a black guy who's bulletproof. So there's a lot that you can do with that. And there are a lot of different parallels that I'm sure we'll find when we see it to our own world. And I think that that is always healthy because it creates discussion.
Yeah, man, I wish I'd seen some of it. I wish I'd seen any of it because I'd have something to say right now.
I have seen the first 7 episodes of Luke Cage, and what can I say about it? It's good. One of the cool things that you may not see coming, unless you've been paying really close attention, is the musical aspect. Once again, to go back to musicals, there's Cottonmouth, which is, who's played by, why did I do this to myself?
Mahershala,
Ali.
What's his name?
Yep. That wonderful actor whose name I butcher and then I feel like a terrible white person about it, but, he plays Cottonmouth is the name of his character, who's a bad guy. And he has a club in Harlem that's basically the Cotton Club, the Cottonmouth Club. And, the show has used that as a platform to showcase musical talent almost every week. Or almost every episode, I should say. Netflix doesn't do weeks. and so you've got these great musical guest stars. Not all of, like, I had to Google a lot of them because I hadn't heard of them. But it's, like, this cool way to showcase musical talent. Chiyohei Dari Coker, who is a showrunner, wrote the Biggie Smalls biopic and is really, really into that whole world. And like, and he was like a music journalist at one point. So this is like a big part of the whole thing. And I know that that's like the least comic book way I could talk about it, but I just thought that was a really cool aspect of it. But Faith Evans, who is Biggie's widow and a great musical talent in her own right, does a performance. And yeah, I just thought that was really, really cool.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
Kind of reminiscent almost of like Boardwalk Empire, obviously.
Yes. Different
periods and
but kind of vibing that way, totally.
Those later seasons when they
in the club.
Own the club.
Yeah.
Yep. Very cool. I'm down with that mostly because Netflix is on a real good like run of hip hop shows with the Get Down and now this, so
yeah. And I don't think that Luke Cage is quite as confident in what it is, like in the same way Jessica Jones was or Daredevil was in the first season. Like I would say I don't think it comes out the gate as strong as those do, but it's got some really interesting stuff to say, and Alfre Woodard is freaking fantastic. And there's Simone Missick, I think is her name, was the name of the actress who plays Misty Knight, who was a comic book character that I wasn't that familiar with before the show. She's fantastic. You know, Mike Coulter's great. So I'm excited for us all to watch it and talk about it, I guess.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to bring something up I know absolutely nothing about, but it is a television show that I'm watching. It's called Timeless. Because they go back in time and have to do something that involves saving the Hindenburg, it appears.
I think it's important
in that episode, yes.
I think it's important to point out that in the notes for our show, Dave just wrote NBC Hindenburg.
It's yep. sort of like CSI Hindenburg. Like that's what it looks like in our notes. NBC Hindenburg.
Which would be great. But I mean, I know there's a couple of different time travel shows that are coming out. It's the season for that in our dramas. But this one, hopefully, highest expectation, if I could put on it, is some sort of time travel fringe, which I think would be great.
Oh, okay, I'm being.
But I don't
see that in this show at all. But I'd be.
Did you watch the first episode, Neil?
No.
So I did. Not to be the person who's like, oh, I've seen everything, but
people want to know though.
I did. I will say that I think. I love time travel. You know I do. Quantum Leap for life, right? And I like that they're historians. Abigail Spencer is like a historian. So she knows, like, so wherever they go, she knows everything you need to know about the Hindenburg, like, immediately. She's the historian of everything, of every time, I think. But, you know, it deals a lot with butterfly effect of time travel, which is cool. But I think it's a little, it reminds me of a lot of other shows that NBC has tried to launch that just feel over ambitious. Like NBC, I don't think has quite figured out how to do cinematic television yet. So like HBO can do cinematic television. Westworld, which we'll talk about, can look cinematic. With NBC, it just looks like you see all the money that they threw at the screen. You see all the CG that they put on there, but it still looks cheap. Even though, you know, and like the new Wizard of Oz show looks like that to me. And like, I'm thinking
Wait. Are you like, telling me there aren't enough polygons on the Hindenburg?
But I think, I feel like you're almost directly referencing shows like Blindspot and...
Blindspot, Revolution is more what I was... Is that what it was
Blacklist.
Called?
Blacklist.
Yeah, fuck Revolution.
Well, no, Blindspot and Blacklist are almost on the level that NBC can carry, but Revolution was just like, you know, they were just trying to be Walking Dead Thronesy, you know, and Lost, and they just didn't make it. And so that's what I feel like the show wants to be. Fringe, I feel, was more contained than this. And if they had done time travel Fringe, I think that would have been really cool. And maybe they will, because I just saw the first episode, and sometimes shows are, you know, figuring out their level, figuring out their speed. The lead actress, Abigail Spencer, who is amazing on the show Rectify, is a great reason to watch anything. So you should watch the first episode at least.
Yeah, NBC Hindenburg
NBC
this fall on NBC. Joanna, nice. What are you looking forward to this fall?
I'm going to mention something that's already started. It started last week. And that's Donald Glover's show, Atlanta.
Well, wait, if you're listening this past Wednesday, haven't both of your shows started?
Yeah. So deal with it. Deal with it, America. So Atlanta, which stars Donald Glover of Community and Spider-Man High School fame, is set in Atlanta, and it's about sort of the hip hop scene there. Well, not really. It's about these people who happen to be in the hip hop scene, and it is super low key. Like, I feel stoned watching it, even though I'm not stoned, alas. And it's not stoner comedy. It's just got that like really low energy vibe. But, I watched the first episode like 6 months ago and I hated it. And this is a good story. I'm going to tell it. And then my old boss at Pajiba, Dustin Rolls, watched it then with me too. And we both hated it or whatever. And then he watched it when it premiered last week and he messaged me and he was like, Joanna, didn't the original pilot we watched for Atlanta have time travel and aliens in it? And I was like, no. He was like, I'm really sure it did. I was like, no, it didn't. And he was like, will you watch the pilot again and like see if it's the same as the one we watched 6 months ago? I was like, sure. And it is the same, but I loved it this time. I don't know why I hated it 6 months ago. I loved it now. I watched the 4 screeners that were available from FX and was really sad when it was over. So, and it's quite popular. Like, it debuted to huge numbers on FX. So I'm really have high hopes for the show. They're going, what FX is going for with shows like this and Pamela Adlon's Better Things is sort of a Louis, Master of None vibe where you just have like a really specific worldview, and exist in it in a low key way.
Did you happen to catch any of Childish Gambino's video work?
A little bit in the early, like right at the beginning. Yeah, I did.
He did like a long, I guess, sort of video movie about like hanging out in LA, and it sort of translates over to Atlanta in, I feel like, the best way possible. So what felt really masturbatory and unfocused when he was doing it for his music, when he's doing it in the show, feels like it's going somewhere, which I was very excited about because I was a little worried. Atlanta's been brewing for a little while, and having been a fan of Community, it was like, he left to do what now? Music and what?
Right.
And, a show called Atlanta that may or may not be a comedy. All right.
And The Martian? I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. Hey, he was good in The Martian.
He was great in The Martian. But he's sort of like Donald Glover. I feel like as Troy, who I loved in Community, was like not so far away from who Donald Glover actually is. And now he's just like, I'm just going to be me, which is weird and like much cooler than like very weird. And I think that's pretty great that he's leaning into that. I'm really glad that he has this platform in Atlanta. The other supporting characters on the show are great. Yeah, it's a really good show with a really specific, like, you know, they talk about like specific kind of hot wings that you can only get in Atlanta, like stuff like that, that like has nothing to do with my like stupid hippie existence in Northern California, but it's just like really interesting because to get really granular on someone's worldview is, you know, the best thing sometimes that fiction can do. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. Boom. I'm going to keep it rolling with you actually, because I feel like it's,
I didn't mean to do two FX shows, season. But like, I did write this big profile on president of FX, John Landgraf, over on VanityFair.com. Please read it if you care to, but that's probably why FX is on my brain. American Horror Story debuts its mystery 6th season on Wednesday of this week, which is a month earlier than it usually premieres. The season is shorter. It's 10 episodes instead of 13. I think we're going to do, are we doing an American Horror Story episode?
Eventually.
The big deal about this season, and I am way spottier on American Horror Story than Dave. Dave is way more into it than I am.
Oh, I mean, this season's been throwing everybody for a loop, but you go and I'll see if I can connect.
Oh, I meant more like, I usually get excited about American Horror Story than like check out after 4 episodes and sort of string along for a few more. And then like, I don't think I finished the last, last season.
No, I suffer through everything.
Yeah, exactly. But they've tightened it up. They've moved it up. Ryan Murphy himself acknowledged that, like, he was like, I don't want to be watching American Horror Story. Like, at Christmas or like in January, which is what used to happen. There used to be like hiatus and then he would finish the season in January. He's like, I want to be watching it at Halloween. That's why we moved it up and tightened it up and stuff like that. But the theme is a big mystery. And here's why American Horror Story is on my list. It's not that I think this season's going to be amazing. It might be. But that I'm really excited that they've managed to keep this secret, which is kind of unheard of. And I know that sounds hypocritical coming from Storm of Spoilers, but everyone's going to watch this. And like the opening credits are going to roll tomorrow night, Wednesday night, as we're recording this. And it's possible names are going to pop up into the credits that we didn't know were cast in the show. Like there's so much potential for what the fuckery. And given that like Ryan Murphy and American Horror Story and FX can pull in such big names, it could be any number of people, or it could be like the people we expect it to be. And that will be fine too. If it's just like Sarah Paulson, then it's like, well, Sarah Paulson, one of the greatest actresses on television. Oh, well. So that's what I'm excited for. I'm excited for this communal aspect that we're about to experience tomorrow night or tonight, if you're listening on Wednesday, of everyone discovering together what the fuck is going on with this season.
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything, too, which hasn't happened since the first season, which we didn't even know when it started that it was going to be an anthology series.
Right.
Just that it was going to be a horror. All I knew was it was going to be a horror series with Connie Britton in it. So, yeah, I was going to watch it. And it's like that first episode, she gets like ghost raped by a leather man, and I was like, oh shit, I gotta watch for this. But every other year it's been like, here's the theme, we're an anthology, you know, no, we have characters returning, this time we have Lady Gaga, and now it's just like basically nothing, which is so back to the center of what I think a good horror anthology series should be, and not necessarily these like, you know, who's this actor going to be cast as this time. Even though I love Sarah Paulson and all of her, you know, various performances, but
right.
we're back to the marketing, you know, sort of pushing the what the fuckery, like you were talking about.
It's so funny because literally today, I was talking to someone who I work with and told them that horror is not my genre at all, and they're like, well, why did you ever start American Horror Story? And I thought about it and I said, Connie Britton, basically. Connie Britton, that's why.
Coach's wife was on another show and I was going to watch that show.
Exactly. And then I just sort of stuck with it. What's interesting to me also is that this is not quite a creative decision. I think, like, to speak sort of a little bit more inside baseball, I believe what happened is that the vibe around American Horror Story Hotel was so, like, the early reviews were so bad. A lot of people really hated that season. And so I think there was a great fear among the marketing department that they wouldn't be able to sell season 6. So it was their idea. They went to Ryan Murphy and John Landgraf and were like, what if we don't reveal the theme? And Ryan Murphy and John Landgraf were like, okay. And this way, they didn't send screeners to any critics. So not a single critic knows. Well, I'm, you know, maybe Entertainment Weekly knows. Who knows? But like, I don't know. Even though I begged, I don't know anything. And that's a way it's going to work. It's going to work so well. They're going to get crazy ratings for that first episode, like, and their social media engagement is going to be off the charts, which is a stupid metric that matters now. So I'm pretty impressed. Like, as annoyingly frustrating as it is to see like strings being pulled, I have to applaud them for this. So bravo.
I'll tell you how effective it is. I haven't watched a damn minute of this entire show and I'm going to watch it.
Exactly.
And I think that'll be fascinating when we eventually do an episode where you guys can explain to me what the hell's going on. If it's connected to the other seasons. If it's not, then that's fine too. So,
oh man, I hope this is a culmination season, but we'll see how far our hopes can go. Sometimes with American Horror Story, it's within blocks of 5 minutes. You're like super happy and then super sad. That show. So bipolar, I love it.
It's an emotional roller coaster, for sure.
It is. But at least when it goes bad, you're pretty sure it could go good again just as fast, which is why I'm interested in my next pick, which is The Flash on CW, which had a great, I think, first season that was a lot of fun, like Silver Age comic book fun. Second season kind of got tied up in its own bullshit. Not bad, but not consistently fun. And I'm hoping that they could go big and fun for this huge Flashpoint thing they're doing.
And musical.
Basically, Barry's gone back in time. So you got parallel universes. Joanna, what'd you say? What? Huh?
Oh, I said and musical. I was sort of, and yes, anding you.
But that's not going to be in the fall. So I was going to make this specifically the Flash Supergirl musical, but it's in the back half of the season.
Dave, do you remember on the Thought Bubble how we spent a whole year arguing over which was better, Arrow or Flash?
Mm-hmm.
And you won?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but then a lot of that was predicated on there not being able to be a Superman or a Batman in this universe, and next season is going to be a Superman. So the Flash has to Barry Allen it up, and luckily the Flash is having his moment. We've already talked about Ezra Miller just by happenstance. That sort of shit's coming up. People, you know, he was in two DC movies this year, briefly, for a shot. But, like, that's some of the most talked about stuff in the movie. And he's at the center of the Justice League teaser. So, Flash, let's do it. Coming in October, sadly. We still have some time to wait.
All right, Neil, what's your last TV show?
Ooh, this is one we'll want to talk about. HBO's Westworld.
Ooh!
Robots! Crichton!
Which, robots. There are, I'm told, screeners awaiting me that I have not yet logged in to watch yet. But obviously, I think it's the most anticipated across the board show the fall for several reasons. One, big sci-fi, Jonathan Nolan, Michael Crichton, huge cast, very weird show. The other thing is that it's another chance for HBO, or for us to see if HBO either does have a drama problem outside of Game of Thrones, or if this is kind of the next thing, you know, because we've talked at great length about HBO's failure to get Vinyl off the ground. True Detective sort of sputtered out after two seasons, or a season and a quarter, maybe. And
you're just going to take that, Dave? Neil's allowed to bash True Detective, but I'm not. I see how
he
it
said
is.
A season and a quarter. That's a quarter more of credit than you gave the second season the last time.
All right.
So I'm interested to see if, you know, Westworld already, from a production standpoint, has had some controversy. It's been pushed back. There's some thematic issues that are driving people crazy. But I have a feeling that if it's great, it'll be the show. Like, if it comes out and just on a character level, on a just intrigue, sci-fi mystery level, delivers and executes well, I think that it will overcome all of the problems that it's had off screen. So yeah. We'll see. I don't know.
Well, didn't they everybody's worried about Game of Thrones too, because they were shooting some weird fantasy costume nothing out in the middle of nowhere. So hopefully buzz, or what is, I was talking about Westworld's buzz. Best case scenario is Mad Max Fury Road, which, you know, went out, and everything everybody said about that movie was like, everybody went out in the desert and everybody came back like tired and dirty and not sure if they had a movie. And then it turned into Mad Max Fury Road. So not all rumors are bad, even though most of the things that we talk about on this podcast are like, it had reshoots and therefore it was bad.
So I've seen the first four episodes of the new season.
Here we go.
Of Westworld. And I'm debating about like what I'm allowed to talk about. Visually very cool, like cinematic, as we talked about earlier with NBC having a problem. Great cast, great performances. One of my favorites is, here we go. Sidsen Knudsen Babbitt, who is from Borgen, is...
Oh, she's in that show?
Yeah. And she's great. And she works mostly with Jeffrey Wright, and he's great. And then that stuff is great. You know, Westworld works on two levels. You've got the amusement park, which is filled with androids and has a gunslinger you know, old wild, wild west theme to it. And then you've got the employees of the park who are working outside. So, you know, Jurassic Park, because it's Crichton, is the first thing that you think of, but like, it's more like a Hunger Games sort of thing. Cause you've got basically game masters working to build this world. I think my personal opinion based on what I've seen, is that it's too much that, you know, once you start listing off the cast members, you're going to go, how can they do all this? And I'm going to say not well. I think trying to track all the different storylines is too hard. Like when you think about Game of Thrones started with like everyone at Winterfell, everyone at King's Landing, and then you had some Esso stuff. Like that's where it all started. And it was only later that we were able to just sort of scatter all our players across the board. And maybe you don't even check in with some of them in an episode. But I think you have to start more contained than Westworld starts. Westworld starts assuming it's okay with you that you spend an episode with a character and then you don't see them for two episodes or something like that, you know, and then you're expected to sort of pick right back up with them. So that would be one criticism I have. The other is, it is very clearly to me sort of a meta exploration of sex and violence on television and what we enjoy and what matters and like what is the ultimate cost of investing in something that's very violent and very sexual and very sexually violent. The question is HBO the channel to
be commenting on their own thing?
Do that exploration. Like, are they the ones to hold a mirror up to that when they perpetrate it probably more than anyone else? So those would be my hesitations. But you can't deny the power of some of the, especially one-on-one scenes that you get with some of these really, really great actors with some solid writing. So, hopefully that's fair and balanced and I didn't just violate any sort of, confidentiality clause.
Hey, yeah.
Yeehaw. No embargoes were broken in this episode.
All right, we're going to move on to our final segment. Neil, books, comics, text, things we're going to read in the fall. Hit me up.
I'm going to do both of mine.
Do it.
In this one, because they're very, very different, but both interesting. The first one is a comic. It's Infamous Iron Man. It's going to be out in October from Brian Michael Bendis. It's one of the few sort of interesting comics that I could find, at least from the majors, that is debuting in issue one this fall. Everything else is sort of midstream, so a little bit harder to find. But Infamous Iron Man, on premise alone, very fascinating to me. It is a story in which Dr. Doom becomes Iron Man. So everyone is becoming Iron Man this year. So that's that, I think, is fun. And it actually goes to what we were talking about earlier when we were talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and how they took Iron Man and sort of made him much bigger than that character had ever been. So I think you see that a little bit in the comics now, where it's like we have we have the female Iron Man and now we have Dr. Doom being Iron Man, and so all this weird stuff and some really good high profile writers on it, which I think is going to be fascinating. The other one is an actual book. It's Michael Chabon's next book, Moon Glow, which he is the author of
Cavalier
such things.
Clay.
Yeah, and the Yiddish Policeman's Union, and the book that he did about that was autobiographical about manhood for amateurs. I love that book.
Yeah, it was great.
So I'm interested to read it also because it is a story that is based on stories that his grandfather told him on his deathbed, and it sounds like a Forrest Gumpian type of thing where it's stories about a man's life and he interacts with different historical things, like different weird historical events that you would not expect. So I'm into that, and I'm into his sort of humor, his wit. So it's almost like a hipster Forrest Gump book. So we'll see.
You have to tell me if it ends like Big Fish, in which case we might have problems.
I know. I was just thinking about Big Fish. When you mentioned that, I was like, sounds big fishy to me.
Sounds very big fishy.
I love, Michael Chabon sort of like hit or miss for me. Like, I didn't love the Yiddish Police's Union, but, he wrote a book called, gosh, I want to say it's called The Final Solution, but I don't think it was called that because I think something else very famous is called The Final Solution. But he wrote a Sherlock Holmes.
It was The Final Solution.
Is that what it's called? Okay.
Yep.
It's a Sherlock Holmes book. I love it. That's maybe my favorite Sherlock Holmes book. So he never mentions his name, Sherlock Holmes, but you know, he keeps bees. I'm excited for that too. Good call, Neil. Can cool. I go?
So those are my two.
Yeah. You should do both yours at the same time too.
Yeah, I'm going to, which is number one, Angel Catbird by Margaret Atwood, which is this long awaited graphic novel comic book for Margaret Atwood of Handmaid's Tale fame. And she actually has another book out this fall, which is called Hagseed. Which is a retelling of The Tempest. So Margaret Atwood, pretty busy. I was so bummed that I didn't get to see her. Like, she was at Comic-Con. Like, Margaret Atwood was on a Comic-Con panel talking about, Angel Catbird. But, yeah, this is quiet, Brian. This is.
He was like, why weren't you at the Game of Thrones panel then, Joanna?
this is like a really interesting, you know, like, I really love the Ta-Nehisi Coates foray into the world of Black Panther. So, like, you know, what happens when a really lyrical writer dabbles in the world of comics? So that's what I'm excited about for that. And then my second thing is The Wonder by Emma Donoghue. Emma Donoghue wrote Room, which was turned into, of course, the film that won Brie Larson the Oscar. She is super, super dark, weird Irish lady. You know, if you thought Room was dark, like, read Hood, like, read other Emma Donoghue stuff. So The Wonder is about tourists flock to the cabin of 11-year-old Anna O'Donnell, who believes herself to be off manna from heaven, or living off manna from heaven. She stopped eating, and a journalist is sent to cover the sensation. So it's not Room, it's like Cabin, I guess, is what this book is. But Emma Donoghue, she's like if you can stomach the dark subject matter, she is just a phenomenal writer. So those are on my radar. Dave?
Dope. I'm going to pick for my comic that I'm going to be reading along all fall with the All-Star Batman by Scott Snyder.
Because ooh, me too.
He is doing a line that is basically a movie plot where Batman has to move Two-Face from point A to point B, and Two-Face is basically called in a whole bunch of people to fuck with him. So it looks like it's going to be a road trip for Batman all through the fall. Issue one is out now, and I think they're doing it monthly. So this will probably take us all the way through the year. But get on now, because it's a great idea for a Batman comic. I'm surprised it hasn't been done like this before. Prisoner Transfer. Let's do it up. And my book side is Alan Moore's Jerusalem, which is actually out right now, but it is like 1,800 pages, and it is a book about his hometown in outside Manchester that it takes place to talk about his belief of how time happens. So Alan Moore believes in like fourth dimensional time, so like everything's always happening and we're like moving through it as a consciousness. So this is the story of a town that he attempted to tell as a way to illustrate how he views time. I read an interview with him that he was starting this book when I was studying abroad there in 2006. It is out now. He definitely was starting in 2006. That's how long it took him to make it. And I'm sure he was very Alan Moore about it all. So it's going to be a slog, and I'm going to enjoy it at the end of it. But Alan Moore takes me on interesting journeys all the time, so it's worth seeking out when he does something this big.
Theoretical physics. Yeah.
Yeah, theoretical physics in a novel, in a long novel. It's going to be like the It of theoretical physics, guys. It's going to be crazy.
I'm sure it won't be grumpy at all.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Already I've read an interview where he's like, all literature that's about the lower class is really written for the middle and upper classes. And I attempted to, and I'm like, oh God, here we go. We're going to do this. It's like, he's been sitting off doing LSD writing this novel. So it's going to take me a lot of reading time, or at least until the Star Wars Rogue One novel comes out, and I have to catch up with that. Guys, that seems like a pretty jam-packed fall for everybody that isn't us, because they just got barraged with awesomeness.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think there's anything we missed, but just in case, guys, is there anything we missed?
I don't think so. I mean, there's plenty of other things we're excited about, and we're going to be podcasting about as much of it as we possibly can, but, you know.
For sure. Follow us all on Twitter to hear our running commentary with this this false political season, but not here on the podcast. Only social justice warrior here. Neil, on a subject that might actually complicate that, where are we going tomorrow? Next week, not tomorrow.
So next week we are taking what Dave and I were sure was going to be vetoed by Joanna, but somehow did not get vetoed. A trip to South Park, Colorado.
Maybe and... I'll call in sick that day. No, I'll be here. It's fine.
We're going to be talking South Park. We're going to force Joanna to watch the last season of South Park because it is one of the more interesting ones. And it premieres the day you're listening to this. It premieres September 14th. And we're going to talk about not only some South Park history, I think, will be in order, but also how the show has evolved over the last year or the last season into a show that actually tells a coherent narrative across the full season, which is something I never thought I'd see with South Park. So it'll be it'll be fun. And I am told that Joanna has a Cartman impression that we're going to save for next week.
I have a Cartman impression, but I really think my Butters impression is better. So,
Butters is my favorite character. So,
Butters is my favorite character. Okay, all right, great.
Well, outside of spoiling who our favorite characters are, I am also looking forward to seeing what South Park has up its sleeve, because as they make it animation wise, it is being approved right now and rendered. So that's as we're recording this, because that's their crazy schedule.
They're doing South the pixels. Park's great.
Yep, South Park's great. It's based out of here. I've been up to Fair Play. I'll try to provide as spoiler even angle as I can to our normal awesome talk about fiction manifesting itself in our pop culture that I'm sure everybody else wants to catch up on in our respective websites. Let's tell them where they can find us. Let's start with Joanna this week.
You can find me most days on vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I have a big Luke Cage sort of Marvel thing going up this week, so go look for that.
Neil?
You can find me on Twitter at Rejects, and writing at filmschoolrejects.com, and I don't have anything big going up this week. I'm just going to write some little things, I think.
Ooh. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me blogging at geek.com. You can find my podcast material along with all of our other episodes at fightinginthewarroom.com. And this week, in honor of the Blair Witch Project 3 surprisingly coming out, I will be returning to Thrillist with something about how the movies have affected the town of Burkittsville, which sent me down a Blair Witch, rabbit hole. I don't think we're actually going to do an episode on it unless for some reason this replicates the box office success of the first one. But by all means, listener, if you want to know anything about the Blair Witch, tweet at me. Let's talk. I gotta get all this information out of my head. It's all been bouncing around in there. So until next week, either tweet to me in Colorado or watch some South Park Colorado. It's streaming over on Hulu. Bye, guys. 3-0